Welcome everyone to this sessional hosted by ASA Banking Committee in conjunction with Deloitte. Today we're going to be talking about funding SMEs. As you all know, if you got the invite correctly, that's why you are here. It's a very interesting topic. I'm sure everyone wants to see SMEs do well in South Africa, and I think it's well documented that SMEs are the backbone of the South African economy, or if not, they employ the majority of South Africans. Okay, so today we're just going to be chatting about the challenges that are being faced in the SME space, and the discussion will probably zoom into firstly the funding side of things as the challenge, and we'll dive into some other aspects as well. So the form of this discussion today, this evening, is going to be in the form of a panel. So we've got our panel here represented, and they're going to direct us into a very engaging discussion, I presume. Actually, this topic is at the back of Lusani's presentation at the banking seminar that happened in July. He touched briefly on this topic, and there was a lot of questions that were being asked in the audience on this topic, and that drove us to kind of set this session up so that we can engage in discussion. So I'm just going to briefly introduce my panelists. So we have Lusani, who's going to be the moderator and or facilitator of this discussion. He's the president-elect for ASA, and he's the public interest actuary for ASA. So yeah, he's got quite a lot of views on the topic and to actually uncover some solutions on this particular topic. Next, we've got Kuzai Chikichi. She is the chairman of the ASA Banking Committee, and she's our guiding angel when it comes to these sessions and setting up events and everything else that we do in the banking committee. And we've got Muzi from Basa, right? So he's the SME specialist at the Banking Association of South Africa. And thank you so much for joining us. And she's left, we've got Louise. She's from NetBank. She focuses on client value management. So she deals a lot with SMEs in this space. Similarly as well, from FNB, we've got Valentine. He also pretty much deals the same thing, isn't it? And it's good that you're sitting next to each other, so you can have an interesting discussion there. So without any further ado, I will leave the floor to Lusani, who's going to guide us through the rest of this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This piece of equipment I'm wearing here, my ears are quite strained. You want to hold on to the mic because it gives you a bit of comfort when you're standing in front of people. In July, I addressed the banking seminar, and I threw some questions out to the audience. There were other issues that we touched on, but the issue of SMEs was one, I think, that struck the chord, and I think that's why we were where we are. There is a sense that many of us have that we need a solution in terms of employment in South Africa. And in other countries, we have seen that the area of small businesses has been one that actually generates a lot of employment and ends up employing the majority of people in such markets. In the US, I mean, if you're just going to Africa, 8%, the formal, informal sector, you may find about 80% being informal. So, you know, business is the way of life, that's how people survive. But in South Africa, you know, it's not a session. You do have the sort of survival type business, but the challenge is always how do you move it from just being survival to being something a bit more established that can employ more people. So I think we are at a point in our development as a country where we have to get all engines to fire from all cylinders. And this is one engine that definitely, if we can get it to work and to fire, it can cause massive changes in our country. So we need to understand where are we failing, what do we need to do, and the banks are here to explain to us how they look at business, the kind of factors they consider, and from their perspective, what would need to be done by who to make some changes. Why is ASA interested in this topic? So I think what happened is when ASA got itself involved in banking, you know, it was inviting this kind of situation, you know, because banking is broad. And there's an issue of risk and risk management. And I would have wished also for the ERM guys to be here as well, enterprise risk management guys, because there's an aspect of what I'm going to share which require that kind of focus. So. In terms of the public interest focus here, our role is to engage with policymakers. This is one of the goals. Number two, it's also to encourage our members to identify problems that can be solved, problems that are of a public interest. And as we're saying, that small businesses have the potential, and that needs to be unlocked. So that is in the public interest to get that going. So that is why we think that if we can have these type of discussions and if we can come up with something that, you know, if we look back in 10 years' time, you know, there is this growth in South Africa due partially to our efforts, I think we will all, you know, can pat ourselves on the back and for the job well done. And then the third aspect in terms of the public interest focus on this is educating the public to understand key issues around public interest problems in this regard, the small businesses, the failure rates, and what needs to be done. So I can imagine that we have situations where one day, Kuda, you are on SAFM or you are on Morning Live, and you're talking about how we could improve the success rates of small businesses in South Africa. And I think there will be significant interest in that kind of topic. So, you know, I want the actuaries to be out there. That's my mission that I'm on in the two roles that I have, is to really get actuaries to understand the skill set that they have of dissecting information, getting insight, and it also play a role to educate the public so that they can make wiser decisions. So that I believe is in the public interest. So a seminar like this will help us to identify solutions for this very important problem. Inequality is the main challenge of our time, and unemployment contributes significantly to this problem. And small businesses are big employers in many big economies, and the only way many countries in Africa survive. What needs to be done to stimulate these small businesses in South Africa? We need to ask ourselves that question. And what value can entrepreneurs add to realize this objective? Now, I'm taking back to a presentation that Michael Tijareva, you guys are kind of present in the chair of profession. Michael Tijareva also was a pioneer in the banking space. He presented an interesting concept in the 2017 convention in Johannesburg, about the role that entrepreneurs can play to de-risk a project. And at that point he was looking at more large scale projects like your construction project and so on. In his presentation he gave examples of a construction project that how it can be de-risked and how this can open up funding. So we know that the banks, I was talking to a banker and said, what do you look at? So now we look at turnover, and there's no turnover, we can't even enter into a discussion. And also just the strength of the balance sheet. I mean, you can't go into a certain kind of project with a certain kind of risk if you do not have a balance sheet that can support that. So in a sense, you know, if all else fails, what can you sell that belongs to you? And you will find many of the small guys do not have assets. there's nothing that they can put up as security and so on. So these guys will not even look at the people like that. Although maybe if he's got a tender or something has been signed, maybe they can. But even then, it's a little bit difficult. So in spaces like that where there is potential, but there's just nothing to show. That there are no assets to show. There's no balance sheet. There's no turnover yet. What happens then? How do you risk that project? How do you package it in a way that these guys would feel, okay, maybe we can do something here? And I think there's an opportunity to create structures that will make it a bit easier for the banks to have a look at that. So banks are supposed to be responsible lenders. Basel and all those risk management tools and regulations and so on would not encourage them to be irresponsible lenders. They have to be responsible. They have to impair certain assets after a certain point of non-payment and sort of default. So that will stop them from even looking at a certain kind of projects. That's just on the funding side. But I guess the funding is an indication of what is deemed to be, how can I put it, investable business or not. So the fact that banks are finding fewer opportunities, and it's not just banks. I think there was mentioned that there isn't a lack of funding in the country. I think the CEO's initiative also raised a lot of money. But it's difficult to find people to invest in because there's just certain things that do not present themselves. What can be done to make more businesses investable? The question we ask today is how can we significantly reduce the risk that SMEs face so that they can be funded better and have a better chance of success? Have we studied the profile of South African small businesses well enough to understand their distribution of success? So talking to one of the panelists before the session, I asked, if the statistics tell us that 9 out of 100 businesses that start are going to be successful, is it possible for us to identify the 9 before? So if you have 100 people pitching ideas of the businesses that they're going to start and so on, is it possible for us to have a sense of the kind of factors that one would need to look at even before the turnover starts rolling in? Is that possible? Is that something that, is it possible to do such a study and be accurate 95% of the time? We know there's always that 5% that is a margin of error. Okay. Is it possible to do that? I think that's one thing that we need to ask ourselves, if I just want to put up some of the questions that I'm considering. So in a sense, do we understand the success factors very well? If one says turnover, I think that's already almost down the line, in a sense. That's maybe too easy. That's not taking any risk. But how would one take good risk in the sense that you're looking at upfront, these are the factors, we've sort of done our study, we can take a risk here. It's obviously there's no guarantee of success. Is it then possible to put together portfolios of small businesses that are likely to be more successful? So in other words, is it possible to even increase the 9 to 20 or to 30? That are likely to succeed in our way. We know how difficult it is to succeed in business, so I'm not going to say to take it up to 80. I think we just need to start at 20 or 30 or something, improving the chances of success. And then, would it be possible to attract funding for such a vehicle? What would that vehicle look like? And would it then be possible to attract funding for that? Obviously, in this space, you have venture capitalists, and they've got their safe and criteria of what they would look at. And so they go before turnover, they go to even like to concept, to just an idea, and then they work with you. So they go way back. And they know like out of 10, maybe one will succeed, and when that one succeeds, they make up the money they've lost for the rest of the 9. So there are those principles at play as well. So one would not just be looking to banks for some of these solutions, so you need other types of lenders as well. But then the other question, which is key for South Africa, because sometimes when you when I attend this innovation summits where they're doing the pitching dance and so on, when you look at the kind of ideas that are being presented, those would be for people who have a university degree or have that level of exposure, it is more complex kind of concepts that we're dealing with. But we also need to ask ourselves, in the South Africa that we have, with the kind of people that we have, and the unemployment rate that we have, is it possible to set up a vehicle or have a vehicle that will have that impact, that grassroots impact for such kind of people? Is that possible or not? And then also the other question, is there a sector that is more prone to success than others, given the reality of South Africa? So it would be easy to go to Stellenbosch University graduates, the history graduates, and do this experiment with them. And it's also necessary at that level, obviously. But is it possible to do it with those that have less education? And what's possible in that space if we're saying that we want to see these small businesses being successful? But obviously, given that businesses themselves and starting a business and running a business is difficult, it may be that the focus should be on those that are more educated and more likely to succeed if they have the right sort of training and the right attitude, because you're gunning for them being able to employ, even if it's 4 or 5 people. Those are the type of things that one can think about. One is not able to solve all the challenges that the country faces, but where could one start and have an impact, a grassroots impact in South Africa in the promotion of businesses? So these are the sort of questions that I thought we need to throw out there. I'm sure the panelists, I can see they are frowning, they're busy thinking. How do I tackle this one? So you as the audience, I'm sure the reason why you are here is because you either are working in this space or you have an interest in this kind of space. So we would also want you to have an opportunity to participate in this discussion. I'm going to start with. Let me see. What I'm going to start with. I'll start with Mr. Muzi. I'm going to start with you, Muzi. You've listened to what I've been saying here, and as Basa, you probably have had this type of discussions before. And I would just want to hear what your take is on this topic.
Thank you. Thanks. I think you're probably right on a lot of counts. What we found is that money is not the issue. The issue is that there's a mismatch between the supply and the demand. As you rightly pointed out, the SMEs that are more successful in accessing funding tend to be the ones that are bigger. Whereas at the lower end, then they start struggling. And that's because the bigger SMEs tick all the right boxes in terms of funding from the banks. They have the right structures in place. They have their finances in place. They have a record. They've been trading. Whereas the lower end, those difficulties in pricing the risk, so to speak.
That's because I do want to make a contribution at this point.
Okay, so can you hear me? Yeah. So I guess what Kuna didn't tell you is I started my first business 16 years ago, and yeah, so I've had several businesses since then.
That's been my fault.
Thank you. So run several businesses on like a very small scale and just, going through the process of just seeing what it takes to start something and get it off the ground. And note, I was actually 16 at the time. But it was quite successful. I even invested my profits into Old Mutual Equity Fund at the time in Zimbabwe. And it did quite well. I beat inflation. So it did sort of gave me a first insight into what it takes to run a business. I guess some of you know that I worked in banking for a while, and while I was there, I was moonlighting. I started my current medium-sized business about 4 years ago, and it's actually in pharmaceutical repackaging and distribution, courier distribution, and it's sort of veered into infrastructure and healthcare and education, and now moving more into the manufacturing side of pharmaceuticals as well. So quite multi-pronged. And you can imagine it's a lot more capital intensive than doing like consulting work or selling handbags, you know, across, you know, different countries. And it's been quite an interesting experience because our operations are in 9 African countries at the moment outside of South Africa. The education operations are in South Africa. Everything else is outside of South Africa. And I guess you can imagine for a business that, there's the retail side, but then there's also the infrastructure side, that working capital is a bit of a challenge. So we haven't had many problems as far as acquiring assets, because we typically go into sweat equity arrangements and IP transfers, and that's helped us with the larger transfers. But then working capital, like for refurbishment of a hospital in the middle of Tanzania, you know, or setting up a repackaging manufacturing hub, you know, also in East Africa, that's quite capital intensive. And some time ago, I was still working at Westbank, so I couldn't be involved directly in the discussion. We decided, okay, it's time for us to raise funding. We can't keep selling our inheritance to get money. And we approached FNB. Well, our CFO and our chairman approached FNB. And I told them before they went, I was like, they won't give you the money. And these guys were like, why do you think they won't give you the money? And I was like, FNB doesn't think like that. They're not going to see the vision. They're not going to see what we're trying to do here and the impact we're having in these people's lives. It's just not going to happen. I work with these people every day. It's not going to happen. There's a certain mindset that commercial banks have that isn't well suited for African businesses that are starting from the ground up. So around that time, I was doing my master's in development finance. Soon after I qualified, I decided to pursue that. And that really opened my mind as to how other professionals put together financing vehicles to be able to fund projects like that, particularly large infrastructure projects that include railways, very long highways, things like that. And I think the mindset that exists in the development finance space needs to transition into the commercial banking space for Africa specifically. A lot of the rules that we've adopted from Basel and whoever else work halfway across the world. They do not work for our environments. So if you see a VC, I mean, VC firms, I think, at the moment, to make returns of on average 40%. And that 40% you're actually not doing well. I mean, some VCs are getting 10x return. But look at a bank and they think like it's something to show off if they make 25% in a year. There's a lot of money to be made that is being made by other people. So anyway, so specifically around this, I think based on my experience in business and seeing how people think within the bank, what I would say is that the mindset within banks needs to change. I'm not saying that the way they operate necessarily in terms of their P&L and balance sheet needs to change, but they need to think about how they support businesses to get to the point where they can then get involved. So I understand why we didn't get funding from FNB, but then they didn't provide any support. So if you think about it, local banks, so your FNBs, net banks, whoever else, they have direct contact with the SMEs on the ground. If you talk to any random person in a township about where they might think of going to get money, they're going to mention the bank they bank with because that's what they know. They don't know about Sequoia and BlackRock and whoever's setting up which fund and angel investors in London. They don't know about those people, but they know their bank. But somehow banks are like, you know what, you're not at a stage where we can give you money, shucks, and they send you off. So the reason why only 9 out of 100 will make it is because mainly, I think, in terms of the supply side, I think it's, and I wouldn't call it ignorance, but it's just like lack of access to information and to the networks for you to be able to make some of those leaps to get to a point where a bank can give you the right funding. And then I think also there's a lack of information and knowledge from the bank side as to how you set up special projects vehicles and think about projects outside of a P&L and a balance sheet that present themselves in the moment. Because yeah, I think there's lots of opportunities, but the mindset that exists within our commercial banks at the moment is not geared for the typical African business.
Wow, she threw a salvo there to the banks, so I think you guys need to defend yourself there. But Louise, please defend yourself. Or agree, concede.
Take up the challenge of the conversation.
Okay.
To go into a defense
topic. No, it's not defense. but I think what we would need to understand from you is your perspective from a banking side when you look at businesses. How do you think? What is the philosophy there?
Look, I think I'm not going to speak for all commercial banks, but I can certainly say from a net bank perspective, as far as our ability to fund SMEs and our support to SMEs, especially business. necessarily have access to information such as how you set up a company, etc. That type of information is available and for free. If I look at the SimplyBiz community platform, where both non-Netbank clients and Netbank clients can actually create profile, log in, engage with other business owners in terms of product offerings, etc. Banks are doing quite a bit to try and educate people, business owners, SME owners that might have the entrepreneurial spirit and skill, but not necessarily the financial acumen. However, a lot of the conversation has been around how do you identify the type of business that will make it. Now, I actually quite love the entrepreneurial spirit that you're showing, because to a large extent you can have equal business plans and on paper everything looks exactly the same. However, it's about your business owner's entrepreneurial spirit and skill to actually make it work that really distinguishes between who's going to make it and who won't make it. And it's interesting that you're in the healthcare space, because if you look at Adcock versus Aspen in around 2013, and you compare them like for like, similar challenges in the business environment, similar things such as import costs affecting their product prices, etc. However, at that point, Aspen was making a whole lot of more revenue compared to Adcock, with very similar business plans, with some uniqueness around it, but it really came down to the management style at that point. But I think that is where this, as actuaries, as quants, as mathematicians, we try to look towards a model to solve something that's also a qualitative aspect to the business. And that is where your relationship banking can actually help your SME by being involved within the business, being a decentralized model where you can actually have access to the business and provide the necessary support. Having said that, banks do take our salaries and invest it in clients. So prudent risk management practices, assessing risks remain important. So some of the key problems there is, never mind a balance sheet or income statement, is there actually a viable business plan? How does a business owner set up a business plan that a bank can actually look at and say, this could potentially be a good operating model to invest my depositors, in other words, my salary earners' money into this type of business? So it really comes back to an entrepreneur has a lot of technical knowledge maybe in their specific field that they're interested in, but that business acumen of how do I set up something as simple as a business plan? Is the geographical or the regional growth that where I'm going to set up my business, does that type of turnover actually support the type of funding repayment I'm asking for? So it's really about going back to business acumen and financial acumen.
That's interesting. Valentin, do you want to add to those perspectives?
Yes, I do want to add. So I was busy as I was talking. I was just busy making notes in my head.
You could see that.
So I think she mentioned, if I can maybe like summarize, she mentioned three things that I can quickly recall. The first thing is banks don't understand the business. The second thing is that banks, in terms of large infrastructure projects, in I guess largely remote places, are unwilling to take the risk. And I think the third one, I guess, as well, is around I guess having that forward-looking view of where business is going to be, sort of looking at what is achieved. But I'd like to say, for me, the answer to those, I guess, three high-level questions falls down to two things. And those two things, I guess, to a banker like me would be, one, risk, and the other one is cost. So risk being, I guess, to Louise's point, we've got, I guess, a responsibility as a commercial enterprise to make sure that we keep the business going on. We unfortunately don't have the luxury of bailouts, fall into trouble. And therefore, given that, we need to make sure that at least our decisions are as certain as possible. So that plays into the risk element. So it's not that, I mean, banks don't want to expand their balance sheet and improve on advances, but you always look at the credit, I guess, appetite of the business in terms of, okay, how much losses am I suffering in this particular line of business, and can I afford to incur more losses? So that's the risk aspect. The second aspect is cost. So if you look at trying to assess individual businesses as they are, and looking at the potential that they have to actually grow into more viable business or big businesses, that takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort, and maybe it's something where I think the banks, we as banks, need to rethink the model. But it's expensive resources that you are expending to try and understand and help entrepreneurs to build their businesses from being a startup to being, I guess, a multi-million brand entity. And that doesn't take an ordinary person. You need a highly qualified person who's going to spend many hours with the owners of the business trying to help them through all the growth phases. And even if the idea is good, it all boils down to execution. So they are very good ideas, but there are very few well-executed ideas. That is a big challenge. And the execution largely doesn't lie in the advisor or anything. It really is an intrinsic value of the entrepreneur. So I think the cost of actually providing hand-holding and all of that is quite massive, and it does eat into your, I guess, returns as an entity. And I guess maybe looking at a model that can help in that way, maybe outsourcing could be a way of doing it.
Outsourcing the responsibility to
yeah, so I guess that mentoring, so much like what happens with incubators. So if you partner them with incubators, because incubators have got the resources, they are closer to the businesses, and if you look at many of the businesses that have gone through a lot of your small business incubators, I mean, they have got a reasonably higher level of success than your run-of-the-mill businesses. So that model, for me, seems to be working, and I think we can, I guess, make it more pervasive in the economy that could help.
Yeah, fantastic. You said you would like to take us on there.
So thank you for your responses. And I think most people are aware of sort of the services that come from business banking. I think it's, I think every bank has it. It's quite common now. I don't think you can have business banking without those standard run-of-the-mill services. But I think what we're discussing today is specifically around, so how do you get them to a point where you can put significant amounts of capital into these businesses to take them to the next stage? And I'm just going to veer off for a moment on something that's not very actuarial, not very technical, but you've probably been hearing and reading about it. It's been a long time coming, and I'm glad it finally happened. So you'll probably remember about, let's say, 5 weeks, maybe 6 weeks ago, 181 of some of the largest CEOs and largest companies in the world signed the statement of purpose for corporations. Yes, that's actually what I mean, the statement of purpose for corporations. And it's been exactly the same for more than a century, and they changed it about 6 weeks ago. So in the past, it took a very Friedman sort of perspective of the purpose of a corporation is to satisfy its shareholders. Actually, the signatory of this was the CEO of Goldman Sachs. I think the only six or seven who still yet to sign were part of this body of CEOs of the largest companies in the world. And essentially, the change to this statement was that instead of that one purpose of the corporation, now there are five. And the last one is satisfying shareholders. And there are four other ones. And those include the community, the employees, adding value, which I think is one on like, the environment. And I bring that up because, exactly to your point, Valentine, that you're just thinking about protecting the business and making sure that shareholders will continue to get the increased return that they get year on year. And that's important for businesses to stay alive, but that's not the only thing. And I think you're going to hear more and more coming out of these very large businesses that's going to change the attitude that people have. The language will change. You won't be talking like this 5 years from now. Even if all that changes is your narrative and nothing actually changes at the bank, you won't be able to talk like that 5 years from now and act like the survival of these businesses isn't important. And again, it goes back to the point of no one is necessarily saying you need to part with whatever money you wouldn't have parted with. But I like what you said about how you then get into partnership. Fact of the matter is that these banks, and I'm not just talking about South African banks, but around the world, sit on these incredible balance sheets. There's some companies that have provided increase in dividends. I mean, I think I did a presentation to Roche. I was pitching a project product to them a few weeks ago, and they have provided an increase in dividends. And each year, an increase in dividends for 57 years. For 57 years. And then they can complain about things like access to market. And my challenge to them is that you don't get to complain about anything when you can do that, when you sit on a balance sheet like that. Them with Genentech and everything else, they own the largest pharmaceutical company in the world. They don't have an opportunity to complain. And I think we're sitting in the same position with banks where you don't have an opportunity to complain about much in the environment we're in. There's an onus on you when you sit on a balance sheet like that, when you sit on a P&L that looks like that every single year, to become part of the solution. And I'm not talking CSR, I'm not talking about giving away free money, I'm talking about getting your hands dirty and solving the problem. Whether it's partnering with incubators, whether it's calling Sequoia and saying, you know what, we hear that you have tons of money. VCs around the world are saying that they don't know where to put their cash. We live in a cash flush economy, global economy right now, and no one knows where to put their money. And then we say we have so many SMEs, and oh, all they need is to just get their books in order. Okay, so what are you doing about it? Because you know what, someone who's sitting in Silicon Valley, New York, or Toronto, or Beijing, doesn't know what happens on the ground here, and we have a responsibility to translate our world into a language, the global financial language you're talking about, the global business language that you're talking about, to bring that capital into our world.
The banks are the ones on trial. I think we're all on trial. including us as the people that can enable some of these things. The question is, so it would appear to me you've got a need and you've got money available somewhere. There are people who've got lots of cash sitting on it and they don't know how to invest it. So something is required in it. And yes, there's a role that the banks can play in that. But I think we should talk about what vehicles need to be set up to solve this problem. Of lots of money there, big need here, but obviously no skills, no books, no what, and so on here. There's a problem that needs to be solved. Who needs to step up to do that? And yes, I mean, the banks are already, in a sense, quite happy with their mandate and what they're doing. That creates room for somebody to come in. And what does that person look like? What does that vehicle look like? And that can help solve this problem. So I think we can discuss that problem a bit wider than just the role of the banks. I know, Muzi, I don't know if you want to come in at this point.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things around this space is that we don't have enough data. We don't have enough data to look at nuances around, say, it's a sector or the certain size of the SME. We tend to classify SMEs as just plain, as if they're the same.
Is that something that everyone agrees with? We don't have enough data on this?
Also not standardized definitions. So in the one aspect you would look at turnover, in another aspect it would be the balance sheet size, and in another aspect it's the number of employees. So it's different definitions would apply depending on who you speak to in terms of what is a SME, and then therefore your data collection is also quite disparate depending on how you define the SME.
Who would typically be involved or take the responsibility to collect the data? If you look at good case studies internationally, is there a country that is doing what we think we should be doing in terms of data and our understanding of the space?
I think maybe not an international case study, but I think one of the conversations that I was having actually today at work is around, for example, if you look at how consumer credit is regulated. So I'm great to credit. Just to explain that it's not the only way of funding SMEs, there's many other ways of funding SMEs, but I just want to talk about the credit piece and also that'll address some of the data holes or data gaps that we have. So the first thing is, if you look at consumers, consumers are well regulated by the National Credit Regulator, but we do not have a similar, I guess, body that regulates small business credit, especially. Right? So your bigger corporates, not an issue. You've got audited financials. You know what the debt service cover ratio is. There's no way that RMB or Standard Bank, CIB, or Net Bank Corporate can go and overextend to a First Rand or Aspen or whichever business it is, because they know the financial standing of the business. But if you look at the small business sector, if you look at a typical PTY limited that is not regulated under the NCR, that information on how much debt they have, what their commitments are, how much money they are making is absolutely nowhere. But if we take a consumer, if we take anyone here and you say, give us your ID number, we can tell you, this is what your salary is, this is what your debt commitments are, we can't give you credit. But if you take a business, any random business, small business that's operating, it's impossible to tell what the financial situation of that business is. That is a big problem. And what's happening now is, with a lot of, fintech companies coming into the industry and basically trying to solve this problem of SME funding, the problem is being exacerbated. Why? Because previously, if you had a few players, you could troll through the transaction history and see, oh, this guy has got a net bank vehicle or asset finance. He also has a Standard Bank credit card. So therefore, I kind of understand what his commitments are. But if you've got like 20 other players in the industry, all with different ways of describing that transaction, it becomes increasingly difficult to understand the financial, the credit capacity of that business.
Okay.
So that for me is, we need a body that's going to regulate credit, that's going to regulate, the rates that are being charged for credit.
Okay. That's fine. I need to go back to Muzi. Muzi, you were still on that point of data, but I got a sense that you wanted to make more points along those lines.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much covered for it. I think also, we need sort of a body that would take responsibility for, say for the credit data. I mean, we've been working with SACA. SACA used to be the credit providers association. It's now called SACA. It's been 5 years since we've been trying to put together the semi-credit bureau type of thing. But because there's no champion and driver for that, it's been taking that long. So I think what we're also missing is the role that government needs to play in this space. No one's pushing this, this one particular project. If there was commitment around and a champion to push it, by now we should have something that's catching.
Yeah, so I think what the banking committee tends to do today, this discussion was more for the private sector to talk about this and highlight issues that then need to come to the attention of government. There's an intention to have another one of these discussions. More of the government agencies here, and the small business development department, to hear what their plans are and how they look at some of the risks that we're talking about. So the issue of data, the way you've addressed it or the way you're looking at it is more from the perspective of creditworthiness, current exposure of the people that are talking to you. I'm wondering whether that's the full picture. Of the kind of data that we need to be looking at, because are you saying no? So maybe you want to share something along that. You've made a lot of notes on that issue. Yes.
I like taking notes. My short-term memory is important. So around data, so I understand sort of from the bank's perspective that that's what they want to know. That's how their business is run. That's how they protect themselves. That's how they regulate it. But it goes back to what you're saying about how do we identify more businesses that we can invest in. And exactly to Valentine's point, you can't just always have a backwards looking approach. You need to look at what are they trying to achieve. And so you made the point about how it's not just about what's on the P&L and the balance sheet. And it's about the entrepreneurial spirit, it's about the resilience of the business owner. but also a business owner's track record. It's good to invest in someone who's run 10 businesses. They've seen a few things, as opposed to someone who's winging it for the first time. You learn a lot of things, and life just humbles you, and you're just generally more cautious as you go along. So things like that, I think, are important. But the challenge is that a lot of that additional data is often not structured. I mean, forward-looking, I mean, you can have your business plan, and people have their projections. All of my friends who are in business and who've done extremely well for themselves, none of them had a business plan that they actually stuck to. If they had a business plan, it was just so to keep the bank happy. And it's like it's an open secret amongst entrepreneurs that business plans are a tick box exercise, and everyone knows that the script is going to change at least 100 times before you get the end
so
of the line.
So they did not have a business plan. What
so
did they have?
When they did have business plans, it was because they knew
okay,
they had
that,
to
that part
plan.
I understand.
Yeah.
So a business plan was not that important. That's what
yeah.
I'm getting from.
Yes. So
what
I mean,
was important? Then what did you
an idea that you're convinced will work, and that's not something you can quantify, that's not something you can convince someone else. It's again, it's not structured. I don't even think it's unstructured. It's
so
sort
of a conviction that
yes, which is why VCs invest in people. They don't invest in ideas. If you know the story of Instagram, there was no Instagram. It was a completely different idea, and the night before they had to do the final pitch, they came up with Instagram, literally a bunch of pictures and people being able to show them to each other. And we have Instagram now. So someone being convinced that this will probably work. Some of the big fintechs that started off that got lots of funding that you know are sort of the unicorns of places like Shoreditch didn't have business plans. But they got the kind of funding that they were able to, even pre-seed, seed round, Series A, because people were like, wow, okay, you're really convinced about this, and you're going to leave your job and be completely committed to this thing until it works. So again, probably not the best space for a bank that is tightly regulated and that needs to still satisfy its shareholders and protect, I guess, that has a very big responsibility in the larger economy. But if businesses, okay, I think for me, if banks are going to position themselves to become then investors in a Series B or C or D, they need to understand how businesses are functioning at a pre-seed, seed, seed A, I mean, round A, round B.
So
it's more about
words,
the IP.
They can continue to operate where they operate.
Yes, but they need
where
to.
Where people already have turnover and so on.
Yeah.
They just need to upskill in understanding what happens at the, you know, at the sort of the bottom phase.
Yes. And,
and then do what with that kind of.
So let me actually share something with you. One of my lecturers last year during the MBA, he headed up one of the big investment banking divisions within Goldman Sachs for, I think, about 15 years. And he was sharing sort of where it's going and the type of people that they're hiring now. It's still in its early days, but investment bankers will look very different 10 years from now. And the reason being, they're starting to understand that it's not good enough to hire someone who just knows how to build a financial model or who can speak credit language. They are starting to hire people with some level of business knowledge and some level of industry expertise. So if you're going to come and you're going to be an investment banker in the pharmaceutical space, you can no longer now come cold call. Like, you need to actually have worked in some kind of business, run a business, worked in that specific industry. And it's because they realize that it's quite important, particularly if you want to be an activist sort of hedge fund, for example, for you to understand how businesses run, because you sit at a very delicate space between investors and the company. So they're starting to recognize that they have a pivotal role to play if they're going to actually effect some of the changes they want to see. So I think it's more about maintaining an open mindset. And again, in terms of how you translate it into an Excel spreadsheet, yeah, I don't think that actually exists, but building that IP within your people. And I think the core, I guess, to actuaries is that an actuary is just an actuary is just an actuary. You're not actually going to be relevant and valuable in whichever business you're in if you don't have wider knowledge of the space you're working in. So if you're working in business banking, you might want to learn something about how businesses are run.
Yeah. So what I need want to challenge us to do, looking at South Africa and its experience and the experience that you have of South Africa as well. Let's talk about what is working in that space. So the space I'm talking about is that one between the money and the problems. And what is working? Earlier on you mentioned that the incubators seem to be getting something right. You may have examples that you can talk about of a specific incubator and maybe the knowledge that you have of how they operate that improves that 9 to ranking and so on. Can we talk about that? Do we have pockets of excellence in South Africa of solving this problem that we have?
Yes, I do, but I'm not sure if I want to mention names, though. Yeah, I think, can I just, maybe...
Okay, sure, you need to do incubator team.
Yeah, but I do know quite a few, and the reason why I don't want to mention names is because some of the incubators are backed by FNB, some of them are backed by our competitors, etc. So each one of them have got some bank that's backing them, so I don't want to encroach into other people's territory, but that model has been working well. I'll tell you, I guess, one of the businesses that we've funded actually is probably like a service that, you know, many of us now are using, and they've been incredibly successful. They've even gone on to raise funding from the US, in terms of their plans are concerned, and there's many other examples that I've seen. But I want to go back to the problem that you mentioned around what I want to call innovative business interface. So now we're no longer talking about these tech type businesses that you and I can relate to. We are now talking about businesses that serve the most basic of needs in the economy, and how those are being funded. And one of the things that you and I may not know is there's been a lot of activity in that space. I guess some of the banks have actually stepped in to help. But if you go to the township business, right? You go to the township business and you try and understand how those businesses work. I mean, the hair salons that are there, the taverns, the spaza shops, and how those businesses are funded. There's actually quite some interesting work that's going on there around how you can actually start, first of all, measuring the activity, the levels of activity, of economic activity that's happening there by some sort of record keeping and knowing, okay, how much trading is going on there, and then also being able to, I guess, come in with a level of finance. And finance, not in the sense that you give someone 2,000 rand into their bank account and say, well, look, go and build your business, but more understanding that you are in the hairdressing industry, you need chemical 1, 2, 3, and 4 to run your business. We are going to make sure that you get that conveniently, and you are able to do some trading, and then you repay the money that's required, and then the cycle continues, right? So you take the profits, and then you reinvest some of it into buying more of your supplies, and there's like a whole, I guess, supply chain that's been built around that, and that for me is working well, and the reason why it's working well is because I guess to what Kudzai was saying is that level of immersion in terms of understanding what does this business actually do? What is the day-to-day struggles of this business? Where can I actually step into help? Right? And that's why I say if banks were to employ an army of people to go into all the different types of businesses and try and understand this, it'll be impossible to govern. But if you try and say, look, we know, let's say, Macro, for example, or Unilever knows that 80% of product A is actually being used by a certain segment of people. Then they can go in there and do some field work and say, how can we help these people to build their businesses? I mean, Unilever has done it, Coca-Cola has done it, Macro has done it, and there's a lot of other examples of, I guess, businesses that have actually stepped into that low, very, very low, I guess, survivalist type of business, and really help them to build and to grow. And some of them are being backed, obviously, by some lenders to ensure that they're not in breach of
I think I want us to delve a bit into that type of model. I think you're raising very interesting things. First, I get excited because I can see the grassroots impact there. So I know. Remember just you know, the story of Ahmed Mashaba with the what was his brand again?
Like Me.
And how in the townships, you know, that was the thing, you know, and distributing those type of products. And I mean, in that space, you can speak of the herbal lives of this world, and you know, the sort of a more product-driven business that then goes into the grassroots, and you see people, and also just the telcos. Selling of airtime. So there are these examples And I guess maybe the question is, what are the factors here? And when we talk about those things that I've just mentioned now, what are the factors here? What makes these type of models work? I think that is something that we need to understand, because when we spoke about data and understanding data and so on, we said, you know, the understanding of which sector is doing well, or, you know, the profile of the sectors that have the potential to work for South Africans, what are those? I mean, the issue of spaza shops is an interesting one, because essentially South Africans have been crowded out of that space by entrepreneurs that are really, they know what they're doing in that space. They're cutthroat. I mean, I don't know what their margins are. They're probably like a few cents. But they run it, and that's what they do. It's inbuilt in them. They make it work. And I guess if we're not looking at who come from where, that would have been a very interesting space for the banks, wouldn't it? How the Somalians or the Ethiopians, how they make these spaza shops in the remotest of areas to work the way they do with the kind of activity. I want us to delve a little bit maybe into these type of models.
Yeah, I can't specifically speak necessarily to a remote spaza shop type environment, but if we take, I enjoy going back into history to learn from, you know, some of the events that happened, but again, back to healthcare, which is quite close to me. My dad's a pharmacist, retired now. So when studying to become a pharmacist, your first point was you're going to open your own pharmacy. You weren't going to work at a Clicks in a pharmacy. It was an entrepreneurial spirit where you would then employ 4 or 5 people. Your seed funding would not come from a traditional bank. It will come from South African druggists, Goldstein. And it was very easy to get funding, even at points where interest rates were 21%. But it wasn't banks funding these startups with depositors. It was venture capitalists willing to put up the necessary capital whilst also being the wholesalers of the product. So some of the arrangements there is something like, yes, we'll fund you, but you need to buy 80% of your product from us. So closing that loop between the supplier of the product into the business, where you buy your product from, and banks who then go and fund, let's say, druggists or a Goldstein, which is a much larger corporation with a solid balance sheet, income statement from which you can invest a depositor's money into. So it's really about how do we attract those types of wholesalers into the country that want to invest in these types of businesses, from seed, angel investing, venture capital, because you are essentially putting capital at risk. And banks have a very big responsibility to ensure we protect depositors. There's no question about that. Whereas your venture capitalist is willing to put capital at risk. And that's the only thing that they take that would have risk. So it's how do we attract, as a country, from a policy perspective, from the view to the world, that there's business here, come invest in SI Inc., if you will.
So it seems to me, and that's what I want to delve in, as an HR, you want to see what's the common denominator here, what are the factors, what am I learning here? So in the space where you've got a wholesaler, you've got somebody who's got some money that they're willing to risk because there is a benefit for them. They get to sell more of their products, more of their products.
They lock in that value chain as well.
They lock into the value chain.
I will fund you, yes, but you need to buy 80% of your product from us. So already they've got their margin locked in. So the funding that happens there is really not putting, again, your depositor at risk, but it's putting capital at risk. If there is a default, the wholesaler will go immediately extract their product from said business. And they also have that very deep level of knowledge in a specific sector.
Because in a sense, they're collecting data on those retailers.
Yes, because one pharmacy, for example, filed, there's 50 more that they're financing from a capital perspective and locking in those margins.
In other words, there's also diversification.
Yes,
it's a whole portfolio that they're looking at.
Exactly. So it's a different funding model to just looking towards banks to solve a funding problem, but there's certainly a lot of support that banks can provide in environments like this at the moment. So there's also the other side of the coin where, again, in those environments where there were 29% interest rates, at to funding was not a problem. You could easily get 50,000 rand to finance a pharmacy where you could buy for 35,000 rand.
Okay.
So access to funding wasn't a problem. The problem was too much access to funding without the necessary the business support in how to make a turnover into an EBITDA into something that actually makes a profit. And I think that is quite changed in the South African context. Banks do a lot to educate. There's a lot of information available, but it also comes with access to information.
Okay.
If you look at the Singapore environment, data is cheap, electricity is on at all times, and public transport works. So if you look at that from what could make an SME successful, it is those, can I actually access my clients on the digital platforms where clients actually come together, business and clients come together? Is it cheap for me to do so? Do I have the necessary access to educate, given the new world we're living in?
So there are barriers of entry or just things that, that make it difficult to operate. And some of those things are things that we'll raise when we speak with government. But I think from where we are, we need to have a sense of which sectors of our economy could similar types of models or any other kind of model that can have a sort of a massive impact. That is something that I think we need to challenge ourselves to think about. Muzi Yisinti was on my contribution.
So what you get when we have to deal with the banks is that when you get them together in a room and you have to ask them questions, they don't want to talk about, they don't want to, they're so competitive, they don't want the other to know what they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult. There's a lot of stuff that they're doing, but they don't get to share because they don't want to get the cat out of the bag before they see if it works or not. And to link that to the data part, we found out that there's 2 million SMEs in South Africa, former SMEs. In fact, I think it was 2.3 in 2008. It's 2 now, so it's in decline. And in that decline, when we looked at the figures, we saw that agriculture is actually growing.
Agriculture is growing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we asked the banks why that's the case. They say, no, it's off a low base, that's why it's growing. But they don't want to say what they're doing in agriculture.
Are they doing something?
It seems that they're doing something. It's the one thing that I picked up around enterprise development is that they are now talking to their corporate clients to support enterprise development stuff. So they talk to a Pick and Pay, which supports some black farmers and guarantees some offtake from the black farmers. So on the back of that, the banks then do work around that. So these things are sort of interlinked.
Hey, Mara, you do want to share that?
Listen.
That's the question that I was asking to understand such initiatives and you're keeping it to yourself.
They want to let the canals back down.
Uh-huh.
This is what they want. So.
Because, I mean, that's the kind of thing, that is the question that I'm asking.
Mm.
What are the kind of vehicles, what are the type of arrangements that can work in South Africa? So I think, Muzi, you are sharing something with very, very, very.
But that's the thing, that we don't have the data that would give us those things. No one's collecting the data.
So in terms of the data collection, because obviously I think actuaries get excited when they hear data, because we are that way inclined. Who does anything remotely? Who are the people that are involved in doing research on SMEs and that? I mean, do we have agencies that you know this is the go-to?
But there's a South African Small Business Institute. They actually have a wealth of information and papers that they release on the context of things that affect SMEs. So they talk around regulatory aspects. Labor laws, types of rate, the cost of red tape that the SME can actually go to, but in terms of data, team data specifically, but they do have a lot of research reports that they do release on that. I wouldn't say it's their responsibility, but it is an institution that I found quite helpful in terms of looking at research.
So do they do, what is that? Is it more for a sample approach? They'll go and sample in a certain area and they don't know.
I'm not quite sure about those exact mechanisms and methodologies, but they would also take a lot of World Bank information in other countries compared to sort of the South African environment and what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. It really depends on the topic and the discussion, but I would definitely say that is a good resource in terms of what is relevant for SMEs and small businesses in South Africa.
So back on this issue of data, I want to understand then how could that problem be solved? I mean, we have some research money that we don't do much with, and we should be doing something with. If one were to set up a project and say, look, here's 300,000, 400,000, you know, as a start, what are the kind of things that can be done? What's the kind of data that would be useful?
I think as a start, and this is a tricky one, right? So you heard, I think Kudzai is a good example of the challenges that we face as a bank. She started off as a retail pharmacist,
or
not quite the age, but more like retail pharmacy, then there's education, and then there's the manufacturing piece. So if we're to ask today, what is this business, what industry is this business in? We'll say, okay, pharmaceuticals, okay, that's like the high level. So we the banking sector, we've got what you call industry classification codes. And so you would say, okay, there's 5 levels of classification, say, pharmaceuticals, but then now it gets to, I guess, binary options where you say, are you in education, are you in retail, are you in manufacturing, and then that's where the whole thing falls flat on its face, right? So that's the challenge that we face. So we may know, okay, you're doing something pharmaceutical, but you actually don't know whether you're a manufacturer, a distributor, or you are just a constructor, or whatever the case.
You have an outdated questionnaire.
Yes. So that's, yeah. It's outdated, but it's also quite tricky, even if you were
outdated.
Yeah.
Actually, can I just quickly touch on that,
and
also touch on what you said. So on the issue of collecting data with these binary variables, a lot of people are actually operating their businesses across the supply chain. That's actually what the basis, how we started our business. We were like, you know what, people are getting, I'm trying to find a PC term, people are getting cheated of their money, whether it's government negotiating for drugs, or whether it's the repackaging cost. So how do we step in? And we started off with just courier distribution, but that allowed us to gain the knowledge about where do you procure from, and when you're packaging, what are the real costs, and then what are the costs of taking the stuff across borders. And then we learned about that, and then that put us in a position where we could now start having discussions about, okay, what does it actually mean to manufacture pharmaceuticals? Turns out, for most people, it's not actually manufacturing and repackaging are actually the same thing for most people around the world. But then if you look at a business like ours, you'll be like, they don't know what they're doing, they're not focused. That's what most people said, but that's how people are solving business problems today. That's how you bring down the price of drugs. It's not just about fighting with Adcock or Pfizer or Roche or whatever. It's also all the costs that are in the supply chain. So again, it goes back to understanding the things around the business. And quickly, while I'm on supply chain, so in terms of, so you talked about disruption, how it's not just banks that need to do it. And I guess my question, and it's largely rhetorical, is are banks comfortable to be disrupted and to be knocked off as the financiers of preference? And I ask that because GE Capital, Group 5, they've been funding hospitals for as long as I can remember.
Hospitals?
Yeah, healthcare institutions and a lot of healthcare funds. Because in their minds, they're like, you know, if we give you the money to build your hospital, we know that people are going to come to this hospital. They do their own feasibility studies. It's the same way if you want a petrol station. The Shell isn't just giving you a franchise. They already know. You do your feasibility study. They also do their feasibility study. So they know that traffic passes by there. So when GE Capital gives you that money, or when Group 5 gives you that money, they know they're getting their money back. How they're actually managing their finances in-house is a different story from sort of what's happened in those two companies. But they've been doing that for a long time.
So I think, I just want to, don't forget all your words, because I'll be really sure to. But that I think you're raising another, you're adding to this sort of the models that I'm looking for. The GE example that you're giving, the Shell and those guys that they want, yes, there's an individual there or a group of people, they want to open a petrol station there. And yes, there's traffic there and they can attest to that, and therefore they'll give them the money to actually sell. I mean, even KFC operates in that.
Yeah.
Those franchises in a sense.
So banks are not actually funding a lot of SMEs that are successful out there. It's people within the supply chain. So I can promise you that finance, so, and I'm speaking from the healthcare finance perspective, is going to be disrupted by retail companies and pharmaceutical companies and hospital groups in the next 5 to 10 years. The funding will not come from banks. They haven't invested the time in learning about the industries and the potential of them. And also these companies want to lock in the supply chain, both the money to be made from, I guess, investing.
So I guess the question I can ask is that with the knowledge that we have here, which sectors or which areas are ripe for that kind of disruption? Or there is potential? Maybe the wholesalers in that space are not yet woke, and there needs to be that sort of lobbying work for them to, hey, look at this, in that sector or in that country, this is what has worked. You maybe need to structure the way you operate in this way, because there can be a win-win. You're going to be now getting into your market. You're going to have some guarantees there because then you know your market is there, and you're going to be uplifting some people in that market. Do we have a sense of where maybe people are still sleeping, and they probably maybe need to wake up? Is there such? I mean, the Pick and Pay one, the Woolworths one, and so on, I think that was a good one. I think some of the banks caught on to that, and it seems to be working. So I would be interested to find out, and I think it would be good to profile some of these things and talk about them and showcase the success rates. Because, yes, if your market is secure and you get funding upfront, you have solved some of the biggest challenges that SMEs face. All that then needs to happen is for a guy to just wake up every morning and go and farm and keep away the pests and whatever. That's simply what
needs to do. Manage the cash flow.
And manage the cash flow.
You can actually have access to all of those
and still mess up
by not managing the cash flow. That is where the post-funding support is so important. And the question is, are banks ready to be disrupted? There's no question that banks have to position themselves in a space where they can be disrupted and still provide the South African economy with the necessary financial services. But certainly, I mean, you can go to a Tyme bank, in a Pick and Pay, open an account within half a second. So challenging even the innovation from the traditional banks in terms of online platforms, etc. So yes, there's certainly disruption in the market, and I do believe that as, if I can call it, the big five banks in South Africa, we do take our responsibility very seriously to support growth in the South African economy and providing the necessary financial services. But it is, in the end of the day, the first question that was asked, who is responsible for making sure that SMEs are successful? And I actually posed that question to a lot of my colleagues, and just to see different responses. And nobody said it's the entrepreneur's responsibility too. Everybody would say it is the regulator, it is banks funding, but in the end of the day, you also bank on the jockey, and if the jockey shows that they are winning the race with your support, you will bank on that jockey again, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So on that one, the jockey, because at the end of the day, it boils down to the jockey, right?
You will have success in every single segment in the economy, and there will be failures in every segment. It's about the jockey. And their plan and where they
So then let's look at our profile as South Africa and our people and our education system and all the failures and everything. Is it possible to have more investable jockeys? And what would need to be done in that space? And do we understand that space well enough?
I'll say it's possible. So I don't like to think of it so much as lack of formal education, but I guess more of exposure. Right? The more exposed people become, the more I think my colleagues here have been humming on it the whole time. Is experience, there is no substitute for it, right? You can get someone who's never been to school, but because of the experience that they've built, because of the willingness to win that they have, they can be extremely successful. Right. Way more successful than even, I guess, formal people who like to, I guess, you know. Because also, I mean, the one thing that you will, I'm a banker, but I also, have experience in some sort of duplication, but you really have to, in this term that they call bootstrapping, you really have to be...
It's experiment.
Yeah, you really have to be able to...
Could you still in the
game? To create opportunities where opportunities actually don't exist as an entrepreneur. And that doesn't come with any formal education, right? You just need to box smart, if I can call it that.
I want to hear the audience. The audience
and
that
sorry,
like,
so can I just mention something else before? Because there's something that I wanted to say regarding the data collection. So one of the things that maybe some of the institutions have failed at is that aspect of collecting data. So we kind of like rely on the Small Business Institute as, I guess, the data source. But I think there's a lot that can be done. There are a lot of resources. So for example, if you look at what the DTI is doing, so the DTI has got small business development offices all around the country, and these people touch, each one of them touch at least 20, 30 businesses that they have under their arm, and they give them training, marketing, accounting, all of that stuff. And that can be a very, very good source of data that the banks can use. If that data were to be harnessed and presented to financial institutions and say, guys, here are the banks, here are the development offices that look after them, are you able to do something with them? That partnership could create something really powerful. And if we could have something, I mean, I know ASA collects data on mortality statistics for all of South Africa, right? Why can you not have, because ASA, the banking arm of it, collecting data on small businesses, you know, all around the country, all types of data that we need.
We'll put some seed capital there, and then you can top up. Because I know banks like to top up. They like to come at the top. They want somebody else to take the risk at the bottom. And I understand that this is not. But we can definitely look at that. We can definitely look at that. Even in my budget, I've got some money for things like that. So we can definitely look into that. Any questions, inputs from the audience here? We only have a couple of minutes left.
Say your name and where you're from.
Hi, my name's Garrett. I'm not a banking actuary, I'm a pensions actuary. But I just started two companies. One is a pensions consulting firm that's no capital and that's going quite nicely. I started a second company in the FMCG market. And man, have I struggled. So it was 3 years of development. We got the product right, the product is good. Now I need the funding for marketing because I've realized marketing is key to this equation, and every avenue I've gone down, it's so what's your turnover been like? All right, okay. And where are you in? What contracts have you got signed? And it's just closed door after closed door after closed door, and I don't know where to turn really to. So I guess my learning from this is there doesn't seem to be an easy way to access capital. So if you say the money's out there, I can't find anybody who's willing to give me any of it. But perhaps maybe the banks or ASO or someone could work on some sort of way to introduce the business owner, connect the business owner to the capital. Because I'm relatively educated and I can't find the...
You're relatively smart.
I just can't find the access into the right...
So what's the hope of the guy with the upper metric?
Exactly. So how does he... You know, I've gone to VCs, I've gone to... I haven't approached banks, but it sounds like I stand no chance. How do we connect the business owner who doesn't really understand how to access capital with the guys who have the money? And that's I've seen the gap there between the two.
There's definitely a gap. Any other contribution from the audience? Any contribution? We deal with the point. I think that's a very interesting one. He is an educated person who has run a business successfully, which was a low, sort of, I can't say low entry business because he had to study for many years. But it was a bit easier to succeed in that. Yeah, capital less intensive, I guess. But now he's going into something that requires a lot more capital. You need to work with partners there, and there is the struggle. So how does one deal with that? So I think that will then in a way is our last point, and maybe you guys want to tackle that one. Any of you? Muzi, I think Muzi wants to.
I think it's
hard. Yeah, because
they like to. We can take it offline.
Yeah, I think they're interested in me.
Probably won't solve for a problem, but there's a identified, you were looking at barriers faced by financial institutions to fund businesses. And that mismatch came through. So it was a program that was funded by USAID. So they started developing a platform that would collate all SME products into one space. It was then handed over to an entrepreneur who ran it. It's called FinFind. I think they have about 400 products on the platform. So you get in, you register, you say what you want, which sectors you want, and then it gives you options. So that sort of makes it easier for the SME to find possible financing solutions in one place.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And it is this type of initiatives that we need to encourage.
Okay, this is me taking my excellent banking chair hat off and my actuary hat off and my former banker hat off, all the hats off, and just as an entrepreneur trying to raise money, you know what they say, your network is your net worth. You'd be surprised how much time entrepreneurs spend in raising money. Like after you have a product, you can easily spend 2 years trying to raise money. And that's not necessarily just about like sending emails to all the VCs and whoever else and angel investors. It's like getting to know people who introduce you to the next person. Like just getting people to vouch for you. And it can take 2 years to get to the person who's finally like, oh, he knows Bob, who knows Jill, who knows Sam, who knows whoever, who went to school with whoever's kid, and they say he's legit. So my advice is just keep putting yourself out there and meeting people, and that requires a lot of time investment. And, you know, sometimes, so I also run my own consulting business, and it's doing extremely well. It's the thing that pays the bills while I'm trying to raise hundreds of millions of rand for random things. So people ask me why I do it, and I'm like, because it can take 3, 4, 5 years to raise the amount of money required to make this thing happen. I believe in it. I'm willing to wait for 5 years, but I need to eat in the 5 years, and I like nice things, so can't go hungry yet. So my advice is get in front of people who know other people with lots of money. Like network the hell out of it. Like get on a plane and go to that random angel investor like event. Go to London, Shoreditch, wherever. If you find out that the FMCG VC people are meeting in Stockholm, get on a plane and get to Stockholm and spend the weekend with them.
This could die and get on a plane, eh? Very good.
It's a private show. Never in the country.
So I think you were touching on something that I thought we were going to mention, and that is the role. So we often think of the role of government as providing money or I don't know what kind of support, but I think there's something that we neglect, infrastructure. So and when we think small businesses, we're thinking, okay, we are in Gauteng, we're thinking of someone who's opening a KFC at the Mall of Africa. Actually, you've got someone in some remote corner of the country who's, you know, just like the gentleman, they've got a great business idea. They don't have self-consumer, they don't have broadband infrastructure. They've got no way of knowing what's going on in the world, and they've got no way of telling the world what they're capable of. So in terms of, I guess, infrastructure development, that's a very, very key, component of actually helping small businesses to grow. Because, I mean, something as simple as connectivity. So if you are connected, you're able to, get information, and you're able to send information about yourself to, I guess, potential buyers and potential funders as well. But trust me, someone right now who's sitting in Maseru in Mpumalanga has got no cooking clue how they can actually access a lot of the work that we're talking about here.
Yeah. No, definitely, and those are the challenges. The jockeys, at the end we're saying, how do you raise these jockeys? You know, to have more jockeys that can succeed.
I think my last point comes to also a little bit of I'm a little bit of a meme addict. So it comes back to I'm so glad for all the trigonometry I did at school to help me in trigonometry season that's coming up. And the joke around that is that, you know, what do we teach the youngsters coming through school in terms of, you know, what does it look like to be an entrepreneur and set up a successful business as opposed to somebody that goes out and looks towards a large corporation to create jobs? So we already said that how the got a very strong formal structure, formal sector that everybody's looking towards to provide the solution. So it's really about teaching our children how to be entrepreneurs and setting those types of examples. So you actually want to own your own business as opposed to have a job at a company.
Yeah. We have a joke in South Africa, people like to work for the white man. So that has been so it's part of our history that has sort of killed the spirit.
Yes, but how do you re-energize the spirit?
That's where the challenge really is.
Having those influences within the schools to create that awareness of this is it, you can actually do this for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, if I were to use it, growing up in Venda, we used to have guys, women especially, from Zimbabwe coming to sell amatoy in the home. They would be gone for months. We didn't know that they were taking these ones to schools, good schools and so on. So these ones are now here working. It's that type of thing. So we grew up experiencing the entrepreneurial spirit amongst our brothers from Zimbabwe. And you can see with the nation, different nations from the rest of Africa here, you can see that acumen inbuilt in, it's almost like in the culture. You see it in the Indian culture as well. You see that they make things work. I guess you see it in the Zulu culture in terms of the taste of business as well. So I mean, you have pockets in different areas, and I think understanding those, when I say profiling, that's what I mean. What are the kind of things that people can be good at? Once somebody said, no, African people, the ones that you have in South Africa, the brown people, they are, originally they are farmers. It's just that they got their land dispossessed and so on. And I think with my father, his generation, most of them were teachers. They're now retiring. And when they retire, they go to the farm. That's the thing that they were built with. But they couldn't do anything about it, so they had to take education, they had to do that for 40 years. And now they want to return to their passion, and they do it more as a pastime than anything. So we need to understand our people. And what is it that these people can sort of more naturally do and sort of guide them into that? So agriculture, I think, provides quite a big opportunity for South Africa. And it's something that needs to be looked into. But obviously, there are many other opportunities. I think we discussed many issues. The issue of data and the need for data that has been raised. And Muzi, you want to have the last words before I close?
Yeah, I think we need to understand the profile of the SME.
And the profile of the jockeys.
Yeah, but largely the SMEs, because you would support the jockey based on where he falls.
It's a philosophical thing. It's a philosophical thing. The reason why I'm interjecting is that they seem to be suggesting there should be more of a focus on the jockey than where he's at. But yeah.
Maybe there's already a focus on the jockey. So let me give you some figures. We have about 5 million or 6 million SMEs. That includes informal and survivors. We have 2 million informal. And the rest, I think 80-something percent or 80% is informal. Of those ones that are informal, we also have another 2 million that have substantial turnovers, but they choose to be informal. Therefore, why did you?
Oh,
So we need to understand that. So those ones, they probably need access to funding to grow, but they choose to be informal, and you're not going to get that funding.
Do we know how? Do we know how black people bought taxis in the past? In the beginning, the taxi industry. Do we know how they purchased those taxis?
I know.
Do you know? Yeah, no, this is new. But back in 30 years ago, how did they get money to buy taxis? I always wondered about that. Did they save until they could buy another one? Or did they find funding from somebody? I think that is an interesting one. Do you know the answer?
I know the answer, but I won't say it because it's being recorded. But I will say to your point, and also to what you said about agriculture and how that's inherent, a lot of these things is just what you know. It's just education. Trust me, for all the actual education I have, undergrad, honors, masters, then I did another masters, there's a fellow, all of that. Then I did another masters in something completely different. I still did not have a clue what pre-seed, seed, series A, B, C, D, what all of that meant until I was thrown into a very sort of Western environment of entrepreneurship, and that was sort of as the business was growing. And then soon after that, then I spent time in the UK and spent a lot of time with people who were coming from the Far East and the Far West who were doing exactly that. But it took me going that far out of my world, and I'm considered probably over-educated for any job I've ever had. But so a lot of these things is what are you exposed to?
Exposure.
So even like in terms of formalizing your business, it's not straightforward. Ask any average actuary on the street, they don't know. They don't know. As far as agriculture, that's all you know. I can't start a fintech if I don't know anything about fintech. What is a fintech? But then once I know about fintech, I'm like, oh, okay, so that's Spaza, Shop of Ours, or that's, what do you call them? Where we put money together.
Stockfest.
Yes, we call them wrong things. Yes, the Stockville. Yeah, I mean, once I was exposed to that space, the ideas just, they moved up, like quantum leaps. I literally leapfrogged in terms of what I was able to create mentally. But that's because I was exposed to something new. So the idea that as Africans we're inherently only good at agriculture, that's the thing we're going to
succeed. Just because that's all we know.
That's all we know. That's all we've been exposed to. If you show them a thing or two, that's do you know what actually happens in Silicon Valley? They send people to underdeveloped countries. They'll send them to the harshest economic environment to come up with ideas. Uber, the idea for Uber, that's why it came out of Zimbabwe. They send people to crowdsource ideas. They live in our environments and see how can we solve this problem. And then they put them in the Western world and become billion-dollar companies. They become unicorns overnight off of our challenges and how to solve problems in our environments. But again, that's exposure. They're exposed to tech, they're exposed to the psychology around funding and their side of the world, how people think of money. It's just a lot of it is around exposure and information. And I think that's going to be so critical if we're going to see unicorns come out of South Africa and not just SMEs. And the reason I mention that is because I think there's a rhetoric as well around SMEs that is defunct and that could put us in a tricky situation for years to come. Again, very philosophical. We need to be able to set SMEs up for success in the long term. I have a friend who's a billionaire. And she will not grow beyond a certain point, but she's like, it'll make it harder for me to raise funding from government, whatever. But she's able to do that. There should be more medium-sized companies that are being set up for the long term. So as much as they're starting as SMEs, we need to set them up so that if someone was saying, you know what, I'm running my informal business, but if I formalize it, first they gain the information, if I formalized it, do you know what, this thing could become a large company, this thing could attract VC funding from all around the world, this thing could then become a unicorn and then be listed on the JSE. So it's about the long-term game. And whether someone decides to go that route or not is up to them, but we need to put that kind of thinking, that kind of information, that access to that kind of information in front of people. Because honest to God, it's not there. It's really
comes back to the education piece.
Mm.
Comes back to the education. And also something that is a little bit more philosophical in nature is why do so many smaller businesses choose not to formalize the business? And there I think there's a lot to be said about trusting a Western style financial system. Now, I can't say right or wrong, I'm just putting it out there. There could be an element of distrust in actually taking that step. And it's about how do the formalized financial world that's currently in place in South Africa breach those trust issues so that you have those SMEs that aren't going, people coming into the formal space and be able to actually grow because they do have the necessary skill sets, the necessary business models. It's just not in a formalized space yet. So there's also that philosophical side that if breached could also lead to quite a bit of growth.
Yeah. We need to cut off. I think we've covered a lot of ground. Banking committee, it's now your responsibility based on this discussion to map out a way forward. What are the salient points that you picked up here and what are the things that need to be pursued further? You did indicate that you want to engage in government at some point, but it's quite clear here, it's not like we're not going to put all the responsibility on government, we need to go to government with solutions. But I think this was a very thought-provoking discussion, and it's something that should continue. Thank you to the panelists. I do not have vouchers, so I don't know if these gentlemen have any vouchers. But I'm handing over to you, Lukuda. You'll have a bottle of water here.
Thank you to all who managed to come through, and we had people on the line as well who are listening in. I think we had a very interesting discussion, and as I expected, this is just the beginning of many discussions. I was actually chatting to Sani, and we were thinking about actually creating a working group out of this to have more discussions, because there are quite a large amount of stakeholders in this space, and to actually come up with tangible solutions, we can start to progress further. So not only for South Africa, but for the continent as a whole, because I mean they seemed to be quite a lot of talk out there that we're kind of lagging behind the other powers in the Western world, or even in the East as well. So thank you to everyone. There's food and drink outside. Actually quite a lot, because I think we all paid this.
We'll take scouting.
Right, we'll take scouting. Thank you, everyone. And the heads of our panelists.
Thank you.